Welcome to Rosemont Roundtable, where we explore the business of investment management with experts and thought leaders across the industry.
Welcome all to another edition of the Rosemont Roundtable, exploring the business of investment management. And today I'm pleased to be joined by my longtime friend, Barclay Douglas. Barclay has had a successful and varied investment industry career, and for the last 15 years, he has been running Criterium Advisors, which is a firm offering traditional consulting services and specifically OCIO search. He's a great athlete and an interesting thinker, so I hope you enjoy my conversation with Barclay Douglas. Welcome, Barclay. Thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, my pleasure, Chaz. We've known each other for a long time, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, this should be fun. Why don't we start a little bit with your background?
Okay. I started slow, fun but slow. In high school and college, I was much more interested in sports than in serious academics. I was fortunate after graduation to get a job with Robert Baird as a trainee stockbroker. As I got into that field, I was also very fortunate to land two clients who were serious investors and were awesome mentors. They got me interested in the world of investing, which led me to look into institutional consulting. I interviewed with several firms and ended up joining DeMarch Associates out of Kansas City. I was there 7 years. I absolutely loved it. I ended up with 19 clients, and that was really rewarding, but I wanted to make more money. And as you know, the consulting world is a shopping ground for money managers. I accepted a job at Delaware Investments, which moved me to Philadelphia. And within a couple of years, I was heading a relatively sizable institutional business at Delaware. I was also there for 8 years. And then I was recruited to join Baring Asset Management as their CEO, which the appeal was it was a truly global firm. They had offices in London, Boston, Hong Kong, and Tokyo. And that's what moved me to Boston, where I still am today. We negotiated the sale of Mass Mutual, our sale of Barings to Mass Mutual. I stayed on for another 2 years, and then I left to take some time off. A year later, I started this very small consulting firm, Criterium Advisors.
And 15 years later, here we are. Well, I think we met actually when you were at DeMarsh. So that is taking us back some way. Let's talk a little bit about Criterium, because there are a number, not a lot, but a number of OCIO search consultants. And for those who don't know, OCIO stands for Outsourced Chief Investment Officer. But yours is a broader firm. You know, you're offering a combination of traditional consulting services and the OCIO search capabilities. So talk a little bit about what you were thinking as you formed Criterium and how you think about working with a variety of clients.
Well, for better or for worse, I've always gravitated toward doing the things that I love. And I opened Criterium, I think it was 2008. With two objectives in mind. One was to consult on total fund management with asset owners, and the other was to advise money managers on their business strategy broadly, and it can be much more granularly. Then 2013 rolled around, and I had a defined benefit client ask if I would help them outsource their investments. They were on an LDI path, and their CIO was resigning. So that was the motivation. I initially passed because it was a new endeavor. And then I thought over the next couple of days, wait a minute, my primary professional interest has been interviewing CIOs to understand the best methods for running total funds rather than me bugging them. I could do OCIO search, and these folks would want to come talk to me, whether it was Alice Handier at Investor or the people at Partners or Global Endowment Management. So I took a year or so and ramped up my capabilities there. And I enjoy doing it so much because I end up meeting a lot of really interesting investment committee members and staff members at clients. That said, I still only do 3 or 4 of these projects a year.
Well, as we said, there's a small group of people who have done, let's say, similar work to you, although I don't feel it's a very homogenous group. I feel like it's differentiated both by type of client, type of service. Some deal with very small endowments, foundations, or families. Others are very geographic specific. For instance, I know a few folks that work pretty much in the Pacific Northwest. Do you think this becomes a bigger, broader, more global business or service?
Global, I don't know about. I'm actually not aware of what's going on in Europe or Asia in terms of OCIO search. In the US, you know, it's like any form of consulting, you need a briefcase to do it. There have been many, many people who've joined the business more recently. So yeah, I mean, I think when you look at some of the projects that have been done independently, in other words, hiring an OCIO that have done been done independently, some of them have in my view, been pretty poor. I've also, because I only do 3 or 4 projects, I want to know some of my competitors who've become friends doing OCIO search, because sometimes I offload projects onto them, and it's a good group. There's 7 or 8 that I know well, and a few that I think just do an outstanding job. So yeah, bottom line is I think that the business of OCIO search is going to grow.
So let's talk a little bit about the overall OCIO industry, which sometimes can be hard to define and count. Charles Scarina puts out a directory of, I think, 101 firms representing something over $3.5 trillion. Talk to me a little bit about how you view the OCIO firm, how many there are, or maybe how you think about more legitimate versus less legitimate or pure play. I mean, tell me how you think about the business and who participates in it.
Well, I think you're exactly right. There is no industry-wide definition. I will give you mine, and I'll start with 2 activities that I don't think qualify. One is taking discretion over defined contribution, participant-directed funds. Well, a really important activity. I don't regard that as OCIO because it's much more of an HR or legal activity than true investing. The second thing, so many people, firms included, confuse outsourcing with OCIO. If you are outsourcing your private equity, if you're outsourcing your public equity, private credit, that's not an OCIO. That's a singular outsourcing approach. So in my definition, an OCIO is a firm that has the resources to effectively manage a multi-asset class portfolio, to do the research on each asset class and the requisite manager due diligence. And finally, to understand their priorities in terms of which of the 4 to 5 different investment levers they will emphasize in generating excess return. That's my definition. Regarding the number of firms, yes, I know P&I as well as Charles do surveys and publish materials. There's around 100 firms that have thrown their hat in the OCIO ring. I suspect, I've talked to most of them, if not all of them, and I suspect there's about 40 that do a good job. But interestingly enough, a friend of mine that attended a Schwab conference a couple of years ago, this was a conference with about 300 RIAs in it, when the speaker asked the question, how many of you are OCIOs? Almost every hand in the room went up. So the definition is pretty fluid, but I like to stay with more institutionally oriented multi-asset class capability as my target.
Now, I like that too, but that I can see, even though I wasn't there, I can imagine that Schwab audience, and I'm thinking of the kind of more professional, no, not so much the lifestyle, but more the boutique and enterprise RIAs, typically managing a few billion or more, typically managing most or all of their clients' wallet, and likely across the asset class spectrum, they would think of themselves that way, and they would think of themselves as fiduciaries, or they are, but it is more than that. And maybe to that point, Why don't we segue into who the clients are? And maybe when you talk a little bit about the clients or the clients you serve, we'll flesh this out a bit more.
Yeah. Well, again, I'm focusing predominantly on institutions rather than high net worth individuals. So when I think of the clients from a size perspective, the largest number of assets, it's in the corporate defined benefit space. When I think about the amount of search activity, the frequency of OCIO search, that's much more in the not-for-profit space, which tend to be smaller in asset size. Additionally, there's a lot of OCIO search activity going on for healthcare entities. And the one that I think that I can see increasing dramatically are the public funds. And I'm not talking about the very large two or three public funds in each state. I'm talking about the more regional or local or specified fire and police types of funds with somewhere between 100 million and 500 million or so. I'm seeing significant increase in the activity there, although it's just kind of beginning over the last two or three years.
And I would think one of the reasons for that would be just the cost of staff, where compensation costs seem to be pressured, if not rising most places, and also trying to implement a really good alternatives program. A broad, thoughtful, sustainable alternatives program is not easy.
Well, yeah, you're exactly right. The litmus test, I think, for a not-for-profit is about $1 billion, because you're thinking, do I build or buy? Buying meaning going outsourcing. And if you've got $1 billion, you're kind of right at that Rubicon of do I hire a CIO? Do I hire a staff or not? As far as the reasons for OCIO demand, I think there are many, but there are two that absolutely dominate. One, which you just mentioned, is the increasing use of alternatives, which require much more ongoing due diligence and time. And even a well-paid staff oftentimes doesn't have the ability to do that well. Secondly, I think a lot of committees, investment committees, are coming to the realization that, boy, we're only meeting four times a year, and sometimes we don't get a quorum. And when we look at our mindset and methodology for picking active managers, the record isn't that good. So right. I think those two things have been driving outsource, plus the greater visibility and skill level of the outsourcing firms that have opened up over the last couple decades. There are lots of other reasons that people would state: better governance, better back office and operations, and so on. But I think those two dominate.
Going back to the family or taxable side for a second, I think we both agree that just the standard RIA outsourcing some capabilities, you know, using DFA, Fidelity, Schwab mutual funds, et cetera, laddering bonds, that's not an outsourced chief investment officer business. But for instance, as I've discussed with you, the next investment we're making, we're quite keen on, firm I've known for a long time, is running $6 or $7 billion in the Pacific Northwest, exclusively for high net worth and ultra high net worth families. So the client base is kind of 20 to 800 million in size. They also have a very substantial advisory, non-discretionary account on top of that. But they think of themselves as an incredibly investment-centric business, not just offering, but managing the entire investment program for their clients. And so it starts with macroeconomic positioning, what's cheap, what's dear, what do they think, where is their value to be had across asset class rebalancing, and then to the manager side, manager search and selection. One of the really interesting things about this group, and I don't know if you've encountered this ever with any of your clients, Barclay, is that a number of the families of this firm ask and go to manager meetings with the OCIO business. They want to be in the room. They want to actually see who is managing a portion of their money. So For us, I would say that business is functioning as an institutional grade, comprehensive OCIO business.
Well, it'll be interesting. I mean, you'll have to advise them at some point whether they, when you talk about institutional grade, that's different than, I mean, that's one definition, but it's different than whether they're taking on institutional clients.
Right. Right.
And it'll be very interesting to see how you advise them as to whether they make the shift toward actively pursuing, let's say, a not-for-profit world or not. I'll tell you, I don't know much about investing for taxable clients, so I'm not sure what the differential is. I've seen a few high net worth firms who have made a very successful transition into working with institutions. And I've also seen some that say, no, we want to stay pure on the private wealth side.
Yeah. No, it'll be an interesting evolution if that comes. I think the natural move would be to foundations, you know, foundations that are related and or in some way connected to the families. But that's for another day.
You know, Jess, you've made me think about one of the key differentials between OCIO relationships, and it has to do with how much discretion the client allows the OCIO. I mean, the basis of the business is you're giving them a high level of discretion, but some really wealthy families are also very savvy. And they, just like you mentioned, they attend manager meetings with the OCIO. They want to have an imprint on the portfolio. So that's a major differential.
Yeah, I mean, there is a big difference in the discretionary versus the non-discretionary world, which is really what we're getting at. And that kind of, when we start talking about the different types of players, one of the biggest types, obviously, is the consulting world that has morphed into the discretionary world for parts of their business. But let's leave that for a second and talk about demand. I think that you would posit that OCIO is a growth segment, although I might frame it initially like, or along the lines of, like the money management business, there's long been room for many relatively undifferentiated competitors. And so I don't know that consolidation is near. There is the occasional acquisition or investment. A lot of them are independent. We just saw General Atlantic make the investment in Partners Group, as you well know. But they're all different types of firms, some of them growing, some of them, let's call stable, perhaps for the meantime. So talk a little bit about the demand from the client side, because I think that's where you'll come at it, is kind of what your clients, why their appetite might be increasing, and specifically for what specific services, what are they most looking to get?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we've got two questions to deal with. Is it a healthy industry? And yes, from a standpoint of increasing demand, it seems awfully healthy, yet there are so many new firms. When you think about the four founders of the industry, they all have about the same amount or less assets today than they did a decade ago. So from an individual firm standpoint, I think it's more challenging than many people thought. As far as the demand, we've already touched on some of the reasons, the alternative world, as well as just recognition that we're not doing a great job in hiring managers for a variety of reasons. I would also say that for the large corporate funds, a lot of the reason for their demand is they're on an LDI path, and there's very little growth investing involved, or a decreasing amount of growth investing. They just want to get the pension business off their books, whether it's staff and so on. So that's another reason that an increasing number have outsourced.
Well, it is always interesting to kind of marry up the demand side from the offer side. And I, for one, will be very interested to see whether or not some of the either subscale, which is in itself an interesting question as to what kinds of businesses at what asset and revenue and economic levels are subscale and are either having, you know, they've either overbuilt their chassis in terms of their employees and resources. And so they need assets and revenue to kind of fulfill and make good on the great hiring and build out that they've done, or they are incredibly lean and they're kind of one-arm paper hangers operating on shoestrings. And then that becomes the challenging question of, well, what more business would we want? How many more clients in what markets? And that revenue would likely cause us to hire and or improve technology and or do other things. My sense is that, you know, there are a number of firms in positive net flows that are growing and that have a niche. They don't necessarily need to be the largest. And we'll talk about kind of different ways to cut the OCIO universe. I don't think you have to be the largest. I think a lot of the ones that you deal with and have successfully worked with and folks that we respect and enjoy relationships with are not Mercer, Russell, Goldman, or BlackRock. But it still is an interesting, it's an interesting question as to kind of at what point people feel the need to combine, sell, carry on, perhaps at this kind of subscale or very modest asset level. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you've opened up a large number of topics. I'll cover two of them. Size is interesting. Recognize that if I'm an OCIO and I take on a $8 billion defined benefit plan, I'm probably charging them 3 or 4, maybe 5 basis points. If on the other hand, I'm taking on a $500 million college endowment, the range of fees there is anywhere from 15 basis points to 65. Yeah. So, I mean, you can drive a truck through that range. So let's think in terms, when you're considering business viability, let's think in terms of revenues. The other thing is that, well, there's two other things. One of the criteria that I use in helping people select an OCIO is what I call longevity risk. You know, there are some really good firms out there, and I mean with good investment talent, that are at $1.5 billion or $2 billion. Mm-hmm. And you really have to question, will they be in the same form in 3, 4, or 5 years? Because OCIO is really a marriage. Yeah. This is a big deal. And you want to make sure that your firm's going to be around, and some just aren't going to survive.
Yeah.
On the M&A deal, maybe I'm naive in the world of big time finance, but I'm always skeptical that a consultant can buy another consultant or an OCIO can buy another OCIO, because I'm curious about whose investment philosophy, whose portfolio structure survives. I don't think clients are slaves. When they hire a firm, it's for very specific reasons. And when that firm morphs into something else, I think they could look at it like it's a brand new project.
Well, it's also for very specific people. There's often, you know, a handful of key relationship folks, investment folks, now the folks that both make the final presentation and then go on to serve the client and are the key conduits for the client. When those people's careers are kind of put together and combined with other folks where, you know, I'm not even talking about cost savings. I'm just talking about who assumes what role and how do you combine firms where there is an absolutely kind of perfect combination where no one overlaps at all. But look, that's the business of mergers and consolidations. I mean, look, like the asset management business, Barclay, there's actually been relatively little consolidation. There's been plenty of aggregation. Mergers of firms, you know, all the multi-boutique models, firms that have financial partners, none of those are consolidated. You know, the quote strategic deals, you know, deals often with very big firms, global financial institutions who already have asset management businesses. Yes, those are consolidated. That hasn't reached the OCIO world yet. I don't know that it will, but you make a great point. Rosemont focuses on this point as much as any, which is, you know, we make an investment, you make a recommendation to a client for a firm that you think is sustainable, not only excellent, but hard to kill, and probably doesn't have a number of factors that, from your vantage point, are likely to compromise that firm or change its course of action anytime soon. I mean, anything can happen, but that's part of what you're evaluating, isn't it? Is the business risk.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know if other OCIO search folks would agree with this, but music to my ears would be a strong investment team of 15 people seeking to have 15 clients and you know, no more than 18 billion under management. That would be music to my ears. But obviously, there are great firms that can differ from that model.
Well, it's interesting. The kinds of firms that I spend more time with, maybe just because it's more relevant to Rosemont, have been folks like TIFF or McKenna or Agility, Cornerstone, Investure, SIG, firms like that. Would they kind of qualify as your definition of having ample resources, not so big, and clearly not just interested in scale for scale's sake and being high quality investment firms without judging any one in particular?
Yes, exactly. Every one that you mentioned. But you also need to recognize that they're focused on the not-for-profit world and select high net worth. So they're higher fee type OCIOs. But yes, all those have kind of passed the test of size. I don't have longevity risk concerns with those firms, even though some of them sold a major equity share and the equity partner is smart enough to let them run the business as they want to.
Yeah. Well, like the rest of the business, any employee-owned and or human resource critical firm, which all of these are going to have ownership issues, whether they have parents, outside owners, or just, as they all will, have to deal with the inevitable passage of time and founders and owners getting older. Right? You and I, that couldn't possibly be happening to us yet, but for others, it's a reality that they have to deal with one way or another.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, let's stay on this line of thinking of kind of firm types and firm issues. You touched on it a bit earlier. When we go back to the consulting business, basically the institutional pension consulting world that you and I have known and worked with for so long, firms like Makita and NEPC and Cambridge, they are sizable, competent OCIO businesses with bigger traditional consulting businesses. Do you think that there is a continuing challenge in a non-discretionary business looking to either convert more of their revenue stream to discretionary in the OCIO world? Do you think that those two client lines and revenue lines can be happy or complementary bedfellows? How do you kind of view discretionary versus non-discretionary living within one firm and how you look at that maybe from the demand side?
Well, now you're talking about just consultants entering the OCIO world, and I can get in trouble here because I got a lot of friends on the consultant side.
Well, I don't, you know, then, you know.
Well, no, I mean, I think that there are some consultants that I rudely refer to as hobbyists in the OCIO world because, yeah, they take on some discretionary clients. They've got field consultants that have both discretionary and consulting oriented, but they really don't have a specific team ring-fenced to do OCIO, which I think is a different enough activity that it should be more formal. There are a few consulting firms that have established a separate entity to do the OCIO with separate ownership lines, which I think is a pretty good idea. But when I think about the OCIO world, I think about four different categories of firms. One is, without a doubt, the consultants. And to my knowledge, if we looked at the largest 20 consulting firms, 18 of them have opened formal or have opened OCIO capabilities. Not all of them are formal or not. A second category would be the large banks and money managers that entered the OCIO world. A third category would be what I call the fund-to-fund providers, SEI, Russell, Northern Trust, where it was a natural business extension for them to combine asset classes and do OCIO. And then finally, the boutique firms, which many of them were among the founders of the industry. They're organizations that all they do is OCIO. So those right. are the different categories that I look at. And I have my preferences.
I'd look at it similarly. I guess I'm very aware of the folks that are size and scale dominated, oriented by ownership. You know, those that are stridently independent and employee-owned mindset. The pure play group, which we talked about a number of those earlier, that's all they do. They were put into business to be an OCIO business. Some vernacular that you and I have chatted about in the past, which is, you know, which of any of these firms, regardless of some of their other characteristics, are professions, much like a law firm or an accounting firm, and which are pure businesses. And the term that I coined a long time ago was kind of enterprises, as opposed to the other side of the spectrum, which was basically just the lifestyle approach. You know, somebody hangs out a shingle, but when you become to the point when you become so business-minded that you lose a lot of the professional aspects of, you know, client relationships are everything, as opposed to scale, how does this fit into the rest of our company, that people can be moved around, and that there's significant amount of turnover, perhaps at the whim of the owner, depending on what else they're doing. Talk a little bit about that angle.
Well, I generally don't have a big pride of authorship, but I'm going to lay claim to that one because, it was about 20 years ago. It occurred to me that there is this conceptual spectrum, and the number one at one end is the, you know, the pure profession, the investor, and number 10 is the pure business. They don't really care if they're in the business of selling hamburgers or money management services. It's all about revenue generation. Now, on that spectrum, I tend to gravitate toward firms that are kind of between 2.5 and 4. They've kept their original investment MO and are proud of it, yet they are business savvy enough to stay in business. And some other friends that I've had discussions with about this have said, once you cross that distributor Rubicon, you become more of a distributor than a true investor. Hopefully buyers can appreciate that difference, but in many cases I see you smiling. In many cases they can't. The marketing and chemistry carries the day.
Horses for courses. Let's move on, Barclay, to the possibility that perhaps some buyers, clients of yours who have hired OCIOs, have made mistakes or might second guess their actions according to kind of what transpired afterward. How would you talk about kind of the category of OCIO client feelings around the decisions they've made and lessons learned?
Well, I'm glad I planted this question because actually it takes some time to think about the key errors that are most injurious. I'll start with one that we all know, and then I'll list five that are a little more esoteric. The first is, if you're going to do alternatives, which many people are racing to do, they have to be done well. We all know about the enormous dispersion between good results and bad results for private equity, hedge funds, private real assets, that kind of thing. So, you know, if you're hiring an OCIO and you're planning to use alternatives with them, just make sure that they've got a very strong capability, which includes knowledge of these strategies as well as access to the best managers. I mean, that's an absolute given. Other issues, and I think mistaken concepts. Some clients believe that they should be very black and white in assessing results. Did the OCIO beat the benchmark or not? I urge clients to be more qualitative in their assessments. Maybe they use 2 to 3 different benchmarks. They look at peers. More importantly, they assess the decisions made regarding the quality of decisions. Now, yes, this requires a level of acumen on the part of the investment committee members, but it's just a knee-jerk reaction of did we beat the benchmark or not, I think is enormously problematic. I'm getting calls, and by the way, most for almost every search consultant, most of the calls we get are for replacement searches right now. But I've been getting an increasing number of calls that basically follow this format. We hired this OCIO 3 years ago, and many times they're an OCIO that I think is very good. They're underperforming the benchmark. We want to look around. Again, this is why I stress more qualitative than quantitative. I don't believe the benchmarks are sacred. You know, there's an enormous difference between the results for which benchmark you select. Right. So I think that's a problem that should be overcome. The number three, we've already talked about this. Bigger is not better. Many times a client will be enamored by a very large asset base in OCIO. And that's fine if you're going to buy a cheeseburger in McDonald's, you know, their quality standards, or it's fine if you want to stay completely passive. That you can go with a very large firm. But if you're after true excess return through quality active management, I think that size up to a point is an inverse indicator of projected excess return. I'm always amazed when an OCIO marketer will proudly present to me that they've got $350 billion under OCIO management.
And that is because that case, it is important and it's relevant. Some of these large financial institution owned OCIOs, they must be focused on some significant scale and ever growing because their parent organizations are so big that they risk being irrelevant at a certain point. And when they become irrelevant financially, then the question becomes, so do we keep it? Do we sell it? The employees have the gumption to try to buy it out. Do we merge it with somebody else? So size as regards relevance is a big thing in the entire industry. And you've seen it in your world.
Oh, I totally get it. But I think from a buyer perspective almost all the time. And it's, you know, $350 billion in OCIO assets is just not the kind of firm that I want to work with.
Yeah, amen.
Another problem, a mistake that I think people make, has to do with fees, and it cuts both ways. I've had clients who lean toward the low fee provider, which I think is a mistake. Right. And then conversely, I've had clients say, oh, we don't really care how high the fees are as long as they're justified. I always think back to the Will Rogers quote, if you want to get rich, buy stocks, and if they don't go up, don't buy them. You just don't know, you know, at what point those high fees are justified. But I will tell you that if you're an investment committee chair and you've got an all-in fee with an OCIO, and by that I mean the OCIO fee plus the underlying manager fees, if you get that, an all-in fee that approximates 180 basis points, and you've got a proclaimed expected excess return by the OCIO of 1%, well, there you've got 180 basis points that's fixed. You've got 1% that's aspirational. I think that should give you a pause.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this goes back as well to your comment about more qualitative evaluation and not just kind of looking at the quarterly numbers. It requires more work. It requires, and it should be clearer to OCIO businesses, how they are interviewed, what the questions are, what the RFPs and or the line of questioning and due diligence is focused on, and then how much of the information gathered by the client in question is more qualitatively oriented and not just, we want to dissect your performance, you know, 6 ways to Sunday.
Yeah,
and that
to me, that
would tell both parties on both sides what kind of a relationship this is likely to be, as opposed to might be quick in and quick out. You know, we'll give you a couple of years, didn't perform. Sometimes it's sort of, it's the other side of that continuum. It's we've given you a very long time and perhaps we've been a little bit asleep at the switch and, you know, you've underperformed significantly. I can think of a couple folks who you and I know well that have been kind of long biased to value and international, which has been the wrong side of the equation.
Yeah, exactly.
For too long.
I guess there's two more mistakes that I want to point out. And one of them has to do with the prioritization of the definition of risk. Yeah, there's lots of risks. And let's set aside an important one for a minute, which is liquidity risk. I think you're down to two primary definitions. One is the absolute risk, the possibility of a permanent loss of capital. The other is relative risk, what you and I would call tracking error. And right. I think that OCIO clients need to figure out which one is most important to them and not go back and forth with changing priorities based on where their shortfall is. And it's not just the naive clients that do this. I mean, even Harvard Management's guilty of this off and on over the last 15 years. That's a key differential. And the notion of relative risk leads to my last mistake that I think clients make, which I refer to as understanding your divergence factor. You and I and the industry would call it tracking error. But I think that clients are often, well, let's put it this way. It's like Mike Tyson said, every boxer has a plan until they get smashed in the face. Most investment committees are very courageous at the outset when they talk about their ability to take high levels of tracking error until, of course, they have a 3-year period where they're under the benchmark and they've got constituents and alums or, you know, whoever calling for their scalp. So those are mistakes that I think can be the most injurious. There's a handful of others, but those are the key.
I appreciate that. And, you know, as we're talking, Barclay, it just kind of makes me think, you know, what kind of a conversation would we have had even just 10 years ago? It would have been very different from this. And what might we do again 10 years from now?
Yeah. Well, I know 10 years ago, or at least 15, I and many of the people in the OCIO industry would have thought the assets were much stickier than they are. We are seeing a lot of turnover in firings and hirings of new OCIOs. So that's one thing. But oh yeah, I mean, Chaz, I gave a talk in the year 2000 at the AIMR conference, and I made 7 predictions about the future of the industry. Probably 3 of them were dead on, 2 of them were questionable, and a few were completely off the mark.
If you could predict the future, you might be doing something else too.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's finish, Barclay, with the unfortunate fact that both of us are 40-ish year veterans in the industry with a lot of mileage on our tires. And so we've seen a lot, and I'm just kind of curious, what are the overarching issues that really stick in your mind today or that you're kind of thinking about and that you think are meaningful and relevant either to our conversation or just to the business at large?
Well, a few things come to mind immediately. When I'm working as a consultant to asset owners or working with firms that want to retain an OCIO, the 3 top of mind points right now are, how will private equity do over the next 5 and 10 years? It's been the panacea for the last 20 years for many funds. But, you know, I think that there's a lot of questions about it now, whether it's valuation or the reduction in exit strategy. So that's a key issue. Secondly, what I've already alluded to, how much tracking error divergence factor should each of my clients be taking relative to expectations, benchmarks, peers, and so on. And then the third, well, you know that over the last decade, the U.S. markets have outperformed foreign markets by about 7% a year. That's such a huge number. So that leads to the question, do we maintain a to some degree a home country bias, or do we further go global? And then there's another thing that I would observe. I was about 25 when I was talking to my godfather, and he was about to complain about the world. And he said, "I don't know if it's the time of me or the time of man." And it took me a while to understand exactly what he meant there. But now I would say the same thing. I don't know whether it's the time of me or the time of man, but attitudes seem to have changed a bit. I think most of us are selling something. And I think salespeople fall into two categories. One is people that are selling things that they think will be good for the buyers, and the others are selling things that are selling it because they think it can be sold. And I just get a gut feel that there are more people in that second category now than have been in the past. But again, maybe that's the time of me in recognition, and maybe it's the time of man that there's really been a change.
I don't think that last one is so much the time of you. I've obviously done a lot of work and been around sales and marketing people my whole career. And I would say that to that point, it is what they are paid to do. It is who they work for. And when you work for a product-based firm, I think one of my observations that's been increasing here in the last few years is that the product business, the institutional active product business, is a brutal business. In some respects, it reminds me of Charlie Ellis's book, Winning the Loser's Game. I think it's a loser's game to a great extent, but I think that it actually gives the ability for folks that are exceptional and have really strong investment engines to stand out in what has become a sea of increasing mediocrity, challenge and flows. I mean, not something perhaps that you might follow, but the overwhelming majority of investment businesses have either had flat or negative flows over the last five-ish years. And that causes plenty of pain and pressure points that are being manifested. So in general, coming back to consulting, solutions, OCIO, wealth management, those are the business models that we are more keen on. Advisory businesses are just sticky and more sustainable generally. It's a bit of a stereotype. And the product businesses just become harder and harder. You got to continue to play that quarterly performance game. I just think it's a really, really difficult game. So, that's back to salespeople. I think the salespeople that probably have had the most long-term success, yes, they have. Perhaps they've sold products, perhaps they've sold solutions, but I think they've been incredibly thoughtful about how to help, just broad-based help, those in their world. The end prospects, clients, consultants, others they work with, occasionally competitors. I think those are the kinds of salespeople that end buyers want to hear from, because it's not just, you know, I'm a 42nd Street watch salesman, and you know, what watch do you want to buy?
Yeah, I agree completely. I'd also say that the best salespeople figure out good firms to go to. They represent terrific firms, or they helped craft strategies that are worthwhile.
Well, we could probably continue for some time, but why don't we keep it to that? Barclay, it's really been a lot of fun, as I thought it would be. Appreciate you joining me, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. I'd love to get together with you sometime this summer. Thanks, Jess.